Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm the former knuckle-dragging military officer, Ray Powell. He's the former wine and cheese diplomat, Jim Caruso. Jim, this morning I woke up to news that a New York State official and her spouse were arrested after allegedly getting paid to advance Beijing's agenda while working in the governor's office. What the heck is going on over there?
I live near Albany, but I don't go to Albany. I don't know the individuals involved, but it's going to make a great movie one day.
We've been talking a lot about Chinese foreign influence operations. And so, you know, it's good to remember that it's not just happening in the other side of the planet. Anyway, Jim, every week we talk to someone who has a unique take on a specific topic that impacts this vast region, one that, of course, covers from Hollywood to Bollywood and from polar bears to penguins. This week, we brought in a Brit, whom we met in Australia, but has worked all around the theater, both in government and in think tanks. He is Dr. Ewan Graham, now a senior analyst with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. Hello, Ewan.
Hi, Ray. Hello, Jim.
Well, Ewan, while Philippine-China relations are at their lowest point in a decade, meanwhile, Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has gone to great lengths to emphasize his country's positive relations with Beijing. So why should we care if Malaysia's prime minister is sweet-talking China?
Well, let's start with Malaysia. It's a significant country. It doesn't have the size and population of Indonesia, say, but it is centrally located within Southeast Asia. It's a founder member of ASEAN. It's very close to ASEAN. It has borders or maritime boundaries with many other countries in Southeast Asia, it's located close to the South China Sea. So it's not sort of like Laos, tucked away and landlocked. It's also at the sort of cusp of continental and maritime Southeast Asia. So setting Malaysia aside, Anwar Ibrahim has certainly taken a very friendly stance towards China. He's continued from his predecessors in broad direction. Malaysia's been tracking that way for the last, decade plus, I would say. But he's particularly put a rhetorical varnish on it that Malaysia has nothing to worry about, including its own claims, which are contested by China in the South China Sea. And I think that's got some attention, that he's really come onto the front foot to say Malaysia has nothing to be worried about, there are no security concerns. That's not what you hear from everyone else in Malaysia.
Well, the largest company in Malaysia is Petronas, the big oil and gas company. Their current wells are running down. The big new developments would be in places like Luconia Shoal, which China claims is theirs. So you'd think from a economic viewpoint, Malaysia really needs to find a way to perfect its interests and start producing, no?
Well, I think that's sound logic, but the broader argument you often hear in Malaysia is the economy is tied to China, and that is the overriding factor, which trumps a more assertive policy on the South China Sea. But in terms of energy, you're absolutely correct, Jim. And I think Petronas itself has stood pretty firm. They've maintained their exploration and production activity at a fairly high clip. They haven't renounced any of their claims in the areas that they operate, particularly off East Malaysia. But they're coming into a kind of constant friction with China, which maintains a near constant presence within Malaysia's exclusive economic zone around the Luconia Shoals, and just recently dropped a diplomatic note protesting Malaysia's presence at a lot of those sites and its activities, and saying in no uncertain terms that that's an infringement of China's sovereignty and maritime rights, always vaguely defined, but making very clear that China believes that the seabed resources are its, and Malaysia has no right to go ahead and develop on its own. I think what it is trying to do is pressure Malaysia into going into some form of joint production.
Well, so this brings us to a couple of interesting questions. One, of course, is why would China decide to drop this note now when it seems like Prime Minister Anwar is kind of singing the right tune? And of course, it seems to have its hands full already with the Philippines. And just sort of as a side note, I note that the news about that was not broken by a Malaysian newspaper, but by a Philippine newspaper, which of course has an interest in sort of broadening the scope of its allies. What do you make of all that?
Well, I think the big point, Ray, is that it shows that an appeasement policy towards China doesn't work, that China will continue to press and cajole. It won't renounce its claims. It will pocket the gains of a friendly policy from Malaysia, but it won't dial down its own activities. I think the way this has been publicized is probably the more interesting story. My understanding is that these notes are a regular feature of China's diplomatic strategy in the South China Sea towards Malaysia. They regularly protest that, and there's no change under Anwar. But rather, how this has dropped shows that I think it's quite likely someone is trying to maybe embarrass Anwar to show that his softly approach is not working, and that China is continuing to press its claims. So it may well serve that purpose. Who that might be, as you said, if it's dropped in a Philippine newspaper, there may be an international element to it. It could be someone within Malaysia. As I said at the top, if you speak to people in Malaysia's defense and security services, they're well aware that they're under constant pressure from China, chipping away at their sovereign rights within the exclusive economic zone. There is a fair bit of discontent. Defense is seen as underfunded. But all of that is trumped by a political strategy that across the board puts China first. So although we're talking about Anwar, I don't think even a change of government is going to really make a great deal of difference. I think whoever it is, China's influence has reached a level in Malaysia that any prime minister will prioritize a strong economic relationship and be prepared to look the other way when it comes to China's maritime activities aggressively or assertively pushing against Malaysia's interests.
It's interesting because Malaysia is home to a lot of U.S. and Western tech companies, especially around Padang. A lot more investments coming into Malaysia as they leave China, looking to have a China plus one manufacturing capability. So I Ray and I were discussing, is this partially an effort to, we can talk badly about the West and get some domestic political cred because we're seen as supporting Palestine and criticizing the Western imperialists, even while we, in fact, my understanding is they're actually increasing naval exercises with the US and I believe Australia.
I think undoubtedly there's a domestic politics element to it. I think a really interesting juxtaposition was Anwar's very strong position on Pedro Branca recently, which is a small feature disputed with Singapore. And he came out in very strong terms saying that Malaysia would defend every inch of its soil, including rocks. And clearly, that makes a pretty problematic contrast with Anwar's nothing to see here approach in the South China Sea, where he said publicly, don't be afraid, and gone to those lengths to say that there is no issue. So I think he's attempting to look strong domestically on one territorial front, but on the other, clearly putting the economics of the relationship first. As to your point about still siding with the West, well, I think again, there's nothing completely new about this approach. Even Prime Minister Mahathir, who dominated Malaysian politics for so long, was perfectly willing to maintain a discreet but regular military cooperation with the United States and with Australia and New Zealand. It's tied through something called the Five Power Defense Arrangements, which give important access to those countries into Southeast Asia. But I think over the long run, the more this continues, I think the harder it will be to maintain that have your cake and eat it too approach. Because some of the rhetoric which Anwar has taken, not just on China, but as you mentioned, the war in the Middle East, has been extremely strong. He's backed in the head of Hamas, who was assassinated by Israel as a freedom fighter, and talked in terms that will make it difficult for a US leader to publicly engage him. And we've seen Kuala Lumpur actually dropping off the list of regular sites that US senior officials and politicians visit. They're much, much more likely to go to the Philippines, to Vietnam, and I think Indonesia is the big country in the region. But Malaysia's, I think, at risk of taking that for granted, because it is going to get, I think, more difficult to sit on the fence. It's a more uncomfortable place to be across Southeast Asia generally. Other countries feel that. And I think Malaysia's tendency to push in a pro-China direction is going to expose it to those tensions.
So, Ewan, it was about 5 years ago that there actually was a bit of a dust-up between Malaysia and China for some harassment of Malaysian oil and gas activities off its northern coast. And that sort of culminated with the arrival of some U.S. warships, and as well as an Australian warship. Actually, the Parramatta was up there, the Parramatta. So that was, the rhetoric actually did get a bit heated then. Is that the anomaly? Is that the outlier? Is it, basically everything should get back in the box once sort of the initial throes of angst are over?
Well, that occurred, I think, when Mahathir had his second stint as prime minister, and he publicly took a line that warships create more warships, or something to that effect. Malaysia likes its relations with the West to be in the background. It doesn't like the US as it sees it, taking Malaysia's cause on its side, and then bringing collateral damage in the form of either economic coercion or more military or Coast Guard presence. That's, I think, the Malaysian concern and position. I think there hasn't been a recurrence of that, and I think that exposes the problem for the US and others. But when they are there with a large task group or whatever, that's a bit of a mismatch to China's tactics, which are really about long-term presence and crowding out. It's never at the boiling point, but it's always there, and that has a much more wearing effect. And when the US turns up with an aircraft carrier group or an amphibious group, that quickly raises the temperature in a way that raises fears among the Southeast Asians. It doesn't, frankly, take much to do that. Anything, I think, that puts Malaysia in the crosshairs of US-China competition, the Malaysians will usually cry more about the US unnecessarily raising the temperature, which I don't think is a fair position. But it shows the mismatch in the tactics, really, that China is playing a long game, and it's really about forcing Southeast Asian states to take China as something not to be loved, but to be feared, and at the same time to accept the psychology that their economy is going to be long term more dependent on China. And I think, again, unfortunately, the presence of US and other companies is somewhat taken for granted in that, particularly on the investment side. Trade has a very distorted priority, I think. It crowds out the importance of other countries in the investment profile. But we've seen that in Indonesia, neighboring Indonesia. Investment has also rapidly crept up from China in recent years. So I think the economy is basically the main point that is changing the equation. And economy is not soft power, it's a form of hard power, and it can be used coercively. And I think China's realized that that tactic tends to work for it in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, a lot of the investment China's making is to get the Malaysian made in Malaysia stamp on Chinese goods that they can export to the West and avoid some of the difficulties of entering our markets with increased tariffs against Chinese products, Chinese made products. So I think it's a little narrow view of Malaysia to see themselves that tied to China. Malaysia is not a major commodity producer. They are much more in some value-added manufacturing. And again, they're part of the overall supply chain, which includes China, for producing these goods for the West, I would argue. China's not their biggest customer for the end product. Would you agree with that?
I think it's instructive that Malaysia is a party to the CPTPP. So that although the United States unfortunately dropped out of that, it did show that Malaysia is not just playing in the China economic space. It is, as I said before, trying to have its cake and eat it too. And there is participation in IPEF. Two, which is the US Associated Economic Initiative. Not much that's really fleshed that out since. So I think, but it does have its seat at the table. Yeah, and I think the complications of a global supply system are there. I mean, I live in Australia, and the big test, Jim, here was in 2020 when China was applying the economic thumbscrews. Really, a lot of it comes down to psychology, the psychology being embedded among businesses that they don't have other options, that they can't diversify, that there aren't other markets that will take the slack. And put to the test, Australia showed that that was the case. Now, Australia's structure of economy is rather different. We are a major commodity producer, and there were alternative markets that were found. But I think the Chinese approach, as you put it, is to take advantage of the fact that Malaysia gives it access into those markets where it might find itself frozen out if it takes the direct approach. There is a conscious attempt among several countries, I think of Vietnam as well, to benefit economically from being in the midst of US-China competition. It's not all bad from the Southeast Asian perspective. You tend to hear it framed in terms of the security dilemma, but economically, it's given those countries options to have their cake and eat it too. And I think they will until the 11th, well, the 59th minute of the 11th hour.
So you've been watching regional politics, geopolitics for a while, and of course, what we've seen happen, particularly in the Philippines over the past decade plus, is you've seen a very confrontational policy coming from Manila, culminating in the filing of the arbitral tribunal case under President Aquino. Then you saw a very acquiescent policy under President Duterte, and now once again a very confrontational policy under President Marcos. What do other ASEAN countries make of this? And How does it affect the ability of ASEAN to work together?
Well, I think there is an unfortunate tendency in many other ASEAN capitals, including Malaysia, to blame the Philippines for being a lightning rod that's bringing in the downside of US-China competition, chiefly through its status as a US treaty ally. And I think that there's always been an ambivalence about the Philippines to some extent, because it's seen as an outlier within Southeast Asia that's in some ways closer to the US and has you know, different influences on it than the mainland Southeast Asian countries, and that can be quite a prejudicial position at times. And unfortunately, that's meant that there's no tendency to support the Philippines diplomatically, with, I think, the standout exception of Vietnam, which does realize that it's in the same boat. They're both frontline claimants. And I think that despite the fact that Vietnam itself takes a quite a subtle approach to China, and one that's based, as they frame it, on cooperation as well as confrontation. But they have pointedly sent their defense minister to Manila publicly with his counterpart to show that at least, you know, from a public point of view, that Vietnam stands with the Philippines at a very symbolic level from this kind of pressure that it's receiving, because under the those countries don't take the same transparency approach that the Philippines has. So the Philippines has been very much on the front foot in naming and shaming China. There are activities at a lower level of intensity, but nonetheless, activities ongoing against Vietnam, Malaysia, we've already talked about. I think that the point about ASEAN is, if China succeeds in dividing them, they will conquer them. The logic of that is clear to a country that has a very developed balancing view of power like Vietnam. But it's less clear, I think, in the case of Malaysia, less clear in the case of Indonesia, and the other Southeast Asian states have tended to take a back seat. So instead, what we see is that they are continuing to push the code of conduct negotiations, which seem interminable, have provided a fig leaf for China to continue to press with increasing confidence to the level that we've seen in the incidents in Sabina Shoal recently, where it's ramming in broad daylight a Philippines Coast Guard vessel. So to sum it up, unfortunately, the Philippines, although it is an important and founder member of ASEAN itself, has found itself isolated, and its approach to self-help under the current president is to focus on other relationships, particularly the United States, but also bringing in the regional strategic partners like Japan, like Australia, and the European countries, to try and develop a meaningful counterbalance.
So you and Malaysia will take the rotating chair of ASEAN next year, taking over from Laos, which has never been seen as a particularly strong chair. So what do you think Malaysia is going to do with this new authority? You think they're going to push a code of conduct that is beneficial to China and hurts the ASEAN stance?
Well, I think the diplomatic signs from Kuala Lumpur have been rather worrying. We've seen statements from the foreign minister basically hinting very strongly that the Philippines should not be bringing in external powers into the South China Sea, which is code for the United States and its allies. If that is pursued, that's basically holding the water for China's approach, because China has used the code of conduct to try and do exactly that, to make sure that foreign navies don't operate in the South China Sea. That would be a very worrying turn. I think more generally, it's clear that Malaysia is not going to take a strong or assertive approach on the South China Sea. Yeah, China is well served by having had friendly ASEAN chairs. The ASEAN chair power is not unlimited, of course, but it is important for setting the tone of statements. I think that the longer this goes without a more assertive tone from the ASEAN chair, the easier it is for China to continue dragging it out. And I think they've already exposed ASEAN's disunity on the South China Sea to a worrying degree. I don't think that Malaysia is going to change that as chair.
So, how does this dynamic, especially with the Philippines sort of up against the wall here in the West Philippine Sea, and at the same time you have sort of this chirping, coming from Kuala Lumpur, sort of the finger wagging, how does that affect Malaysia-Philippine relations, and what are the possible implications of kind of a fallout in that sense?
Well, one of the complications, as you're well aware, Ray, is that relations between Malaysia and the Philippines have always been complicated by a territorial dispute over the eastern state of Sabah. For some in the Philippine establishment, Malaysia has been seen as a potential adversary for that reason. Now, that dispute has never taken on military form, but it is a political irritant. And of course, there are wider contending sovereignty disputes to the features in the Spratly Islands between Malaysia and the Philippines. But what really separates Malaysia's approach is the belief that it can pursue a bilateral deal with China. It's always done that for decades, and I don't think that there's a significant shift away from that. In fact, if anything, Anwar is more likely to pursue the bilateral closed doors, quiet diplomacy approach with China, and that means that the Philippines is going to be cut out of that. I think that has dawned on the Philippines that it's unlikely to get support significantly from ASEAN in the collective fashion. I think the Philippine approach is a pragmatic one, which is to prioritize those bilateral partners within ASEAN with which it can do business. And that doesn't have to mean taking a firm anti-China stance. It can also mean just making sure that they deconflict their claims. It's pursuing that with Indonesia and under the new presidency of Prabowo, we might see some benefit from that. It's certainly cooperating with Vietnam on several fronts. We saw a joint Coast Guard exercise between the Philippines and Vietnam, but it's really the maritime states that are going to be significant here. Even Singapore, by the way, did conclude a defense cooperation agreement upgrade recently with the Philippines. So it's not entirely on its own. It's just that the collective ASEAN diplomacy has really been hamstrung, that limits the options for external countries to become involved as well. Countries like Australia and Japan, the United States, which have played an informal shaping role in some of the previous chairman's statements, I think it's going to become harder for them to do that. What we see is that the multilateral framework, ASEAN-centered, so-called, is not up to the task anymore, and it's going to be small groups which are going to have to fill the ballast. I think the Philippines has already priced that in under President Marcos. And is pursuing its de facto strategy, of small groups and bilats as its mainstay.
Yeah, we've discussed in previous podcasts about whether ASEAN is it losing any sense of purpose? Is these splits from things like you've just described going to become so severe that ASEAN itself is past its sell-by date? Is that something you're looking at?
Well, the question is, where would the mantle pass to if ASEAN were to give it up? And I think there is no ready answer for that. The whole point about why ASEAN is the default framework is because there's no agreement among the other Asian and resident powers about who should take the lead. So I think that will always tend to keep ASEAN somewhere in the picture. But ASEAN's centrality is increasingly it's a boilerplate sticker, which doesn't really have much significance on the hard geopolitical issues, or I might add, on the central question within its membership, which is the raging conflict in Myanmar. And if ASEAN can't sort out its own front yard internal conflict, I think the chances of it being able to rise to the occasion and manage something as complex as strategic rivalry are very limited. But it's always had a kind of dual edge. I think we on the outside tend to look at ASEAN and rather emphasize it to a fault, whereas within ASEAN, it's always been the case that it has played a significant role in allowing such diverse countries to present a united front. But at the same time, they have always pursued their own national interests through whatever channels are most convenient. And I think that, if ASEAN fails, it doesn't mean that Southeast Asia ceases to exist. I think we should talk more about Southeast Asia as the framing point rather than ASEAN, which is a collective label, but one that has, I think, increasingly limited utility, particularly on the security and geopolitical front.
Yeah, we were saying that with Prabowo, a man not known for his patience, he's not going to play the ASEAN game. He's going to go his own way.
But absolutely right. I think that's clear is that Indonesian diplomacy is tracking in other areas. Indonesia sees itself as a great power, at least a great power in potential, and is willing to play on a global stage and to pursue its own interests elsewhere. And I think because he's a military man, I think he's also his impatience with the niceties of ASEAN diplomacy are limited. He's quite happy to bypass his own foreign ministry if it suits him. And we've seen an interesting development with an upgraded defense cooperation agreement with Australia just in the last week, which shows that these countries are not devoid of agency, even while their collective vehicle is suffering mechanical breakdown. It doesn't mean that that Indonesia isn't active. I think the whole point, as I try to frame it in other articles I've written, is the to understand the difference, the vital distinction between active non-alignment and neutrality. I think the neutrality trap is something that Anwar personally has fallen for in Malaysia, and that's tended to work in the favor of China among all the external parties. We don't see that from Prabowo. I don't think he's in favor of neutrality. There are some in Jakarta who are in the foreign ministry, but I think an underarmed neutral Southeast Asia is the worst outcome for its own long-term security when a country like China is actively nibbling away at the sovereign extremities and trying to force essentially a submissive psychology on the part of Southeast Asian countries.
So let's zoom out for just a second, or at least zoom out in terms of Malaysia, away from just this question of sovereignty in China and the South China Sea. what is it that drives Malaysian politics? What are Prime Minister Anwar's priorities? What is he trying to get done domestically or through during his term? What's at the top of his list?
Well, I'm not a domestic expert on Ray. Make no claims to be. I think money and the economy, surprise surprise, will always be top of the agenda. He also faces some political challenges. There was an election that recently went the way of the opposition. So his grip on domestic politics is in question, I think, in a way that it hasn't been since he took power in November of 2022. Domestic politics certainly shades into questions of foreign policy. And I think that because Anwar represents a multi-ethnic coalition, that has positive aspects in that he's not going to take a purely Islamist political line. But the flip side means he's probably more reliant on Malaysian Chinese funding and business support. And that's going to push him further towards a pro-China line. So it's a question of frying pan or fire in some ways. What we see, I think, that's been particularly unhelpful is a sort of three-way combination of Islamist tendencies tending to dominate Malay politics and with a particular pernicious influence of Saudi Arabian money in recent years that's entered into Malaysian politics. Secondly, we've got anti-Westernism, which has been around since Mahathir for decades. But that is he's mainstreamed that so that I think it's seen as part of the fabric of Malaysian politics to take an anti-Western line, and then the pro-China leanings, particularly as the economy has tracked closer towards increased trade with China. All these things combine, I think, to make it difficult for Malaysia to be a dependable partner for countries like the United States, and the rhetoric that he's really amped up will matter. He's really doubled down on the Hamas-Israel war, but I think that some of that is personal. We can't just say that that's just domestic politics. He's maybe playing to a constituency, but I think he was genuinely close to the former leader of Hamas, and that comes from the heart. In my view, although we're focused on Anwar in this conversation, I'm rather worried that from the question of Malaysia and its relations with Western countries, it is a question of the long goodbye. The longer this tracks, I don't think that there are figures in Malaysian politics who are really likely to turn this around. I think whoever's in charge will take us a sympathetic position on China, one that is reluctant to engage in anything that they see as confrontational. And that's a real problem, if I might add, for Australia, because we have something called the Five Power Defence Arrangements. It's the most developed form of access that Australia gets, but access is only as good as the sovereign willingness of the host country to give that in crisis. And if China is going to be the planning point for Australia and its allies, and then I think what we see is increasing doubt about the long-term viability of Malaysia's partnership. They're not going to get rid of it, but I think it is going to be increasingly in question. On domestic politics, of course, one thing is Malaysia is still overcoming a huge problem with indebtedness through the 1MD policies of Prime Minister Najib, and that left a huge fiscal hole. That's also going to impact Malaysia's ability to reinvest in defense. And one of the reasons China finds it so easy to nibble away at Malaysia's maritime interests is not just because of diplomatic submissiveness, it's a lack of capability to actually hold what Malaysia has and to defend Petronas as the front line, as the main energy developer there, against the resources that China can seemingly effortlessly deploy now.
Yeah, let me throw another scenario out at you. I mean, when Anwar was in opposition, when he was in jail, the other mainstream parties said, that's the China party. You called it multi-ethnic, but they all said Anwar's being supported by Chinese money. He's in China's pocket. He's anti, and he says he's Islamic, but he does un-Islamic things. And of course, he was thrown in jail for on charges of sodomy. So my concern is that there's going to be another outbreak of anti-China sentiment, that Anwar is seen as giving away the country to China, and some of the Islamists start coming after him, raising tensions among the different ethnic groups, demanding more adherence to the Bumiputra ethnic Malay policies of Mahathir.
I think you've put your finger on a broader risk in Southeast Asia, Jim. I think that Southeast Asian elites are largely won over to a closer relationship with China. But the disconnect between elite opinion and street opinion is always latent in countries like Malaysia and Indonesia. And I think that is a significant black swan in the region that which does have a history of inter-ethnic violence. And Malaysia has suffered from that in the past. There are, I think, fewer inklings of it in Malaysia than there are elsewhere. I do worry that Indonesia can always flip back in a very unpredictable way that way. If China exits its hand, or if those countries are seen to be giving in to China's interests at the expense of vested interest domestically, and I think China has that potential. Increasingly, if they play the ethnic card, trying to weaponize the overseas diaspora, then that's really intemperate stuff. I mean, that can light a fuse to very unpredictable intercommunal tensions. And I think that we've seen inklings of that, the way that China has gone about trying to play its diplomacy with the ambassador, former ambassador, once just insisting on ethnic Chinese only visiting a Chinese ship. And that those sorts of games are going to have that incendiary potential, but I don't see it at the moment in Malaysia. I think it's more of a medium term risk.
Well, Dr. Ewan Graham, where can people keep track of you and your work?
Well, Ray, as you kindly said, I'm a senior analyst at ASPE, so that's my mainstay. But very glad for the extend the invitation to talk to you to a broader audience, and I'll be in Australia, but tracking around the region, and hope to meet both of you somewhere on the circuit before too long.
Well, obviously, we'll have to catch you, since, as we know, you are in your car, perhaps on the run. I don't know if the Australian Federal Police are after you, but certainly we'll want you to stay safe there.
I'm always alert to the risk of foreign interference, right? And I stay highly mobile. But Australia is a large country, as you know. There are many places to hide.
Thanks again, dear sir, for joining us. And we always appreciate your wisdom. Say hello to the magpies there and the sulfur-crested cockatoos there in Canberra. We miss their beautiful songs. Sorry, for those who aren't from Canberra, magpies and sulfur-crested cockatoos do not have what most people would describe as beautiful songs. But anyway, thank you. Thank you, Ewan, for joining us. Good to see you again. Well, Jim, that was kind of a timely one for me since I just got back from a big conference in the Philippines. And of course, the tone of that conference was very much one of, you know, great concern about China's aggressions in the West Philippine Sea and, you know, wanting to gain international support. And there happened to be one Malaysian academic who showed up at the conference, and she basically talked about, you know, Malaysia's very pragmatic. But we're flexible. We have a flexible policy. So if in the future things were to go south, then we could always change our policy. And just within the context of how that conference was going, that just, it was really discordant to hear that perspective. But I think it was a helpful perspective because it was kind of a reminder that, you know, these countries, each one is acting in their perceived national interest, and they perceive those things very differently.
I would argue Malaysia's always seen itself as a bit of a contrarian, certainly as regards to its views of the United States and the West in general. As an example, in 2008, during the Asian financial crisis, they're the ones who basically told the IMF to go to hell. Mahathir refused to take the medicine, and actually he proved to be right. Malaysia came out of the crisis faster and better than most. But they define themselves as proudly independent, which means almost perforce opposing anything that the US and others may want.
Well, you know, of course, what this has tended to mean from the Philippine perspective is it is pulling the Philippines really closer to the US and its allies, and just sort of entering this huge area of uncertainty vis-a-vis its relationship to ASEAN. And so when Ewan talks about, you know, ASEAN centrality being something of a bumper sticker at this point, you know, we talked, of course, to some of our earlier guests like Prasanth Parameswaran and others who, you know, talked about that ASEAN does have other features. It's not a security organization. In fact, I think you made that point in our very first podcast. But the fact that the ASEAN tries to be a security organization and really is not able to in this case, I think undermines a lot of the other things it's trying to do.
Well, I know if I were a Philippine citizen and a non-ASEAN nation rammed one of our ships in Philippine waters, and the response from a fellow ASEAN is, it's your fault for being there, that might get me a little upset. And how would Malaysia react if one of their ships were rammed by China and the Philippines said, well, serves you right?
Well, I mean, that brings, you know, the question is, and I actually asked the academic this very question during the conference, which is, if things move south to Laconia Shoals and things begin to heat up there, and all of a sudden you're talking about, you know, China, you know, blockading certain oil and gas operations or something to that effect, what support would Malaysia expect from the Philippines, given its stance toward what's been happening there? She actually didn't answer that question. Not sure if she just got lost in the other questions I asked or if she just didn't want to. But anyway, we're well into story time, Jim, and I think that it must be your turn. So tell me a story. Tell me a where I was story.
Okay. So 2016, 2017, I was director of the Office for Southeast Asia Maritime, which includes Malaysia, at State Department. And I was sent off to Malaysia to meet the folks there. And one of the people I met were Anwar's daughter. At the time, Anwar was in jail for the second time, being accused of sodomy by the prime minister. He was deputy prime minister when this accusation was made. And the United States was trying to convince Mahathir and the Malaysians that really you should let this man go. He's sick. He had a bad back. I met with his daughter and two of the senior members of Anwar's party, who encouraged me in strong words, please do more, press Malaysia harder to release Anwar. We put Malaysia on the list, the Human Rights Watch list of countries violating human rights, in part because of the jailing of Mahathir. So seeing Mahathir now supporting China, which, by the way, did not support
Mahathir Anwar, you mean?
Pardon me?
Seeing Anwar now, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Seeing Anwar in power and taking such anti-American views, not just opposing our policies, but being quite opposed to the U.S. in general, it makes you wonder why that is.
Yeah. Well, I guess they say a year is a long time in politics, and 7 years is a very long time, I suppose, huh?
Indeed. But as I was saying to you, and I do get concerned about inter-ethnic tensions and rivalries, and this could exacerbate it.
Yeah. Well, just sort of thinking back to some previous discussions we've had about President Duterte in the Philippines, you know, of course, his anti-Americanism was long held. It wasn't that he had no use for America at all, but, you know, his basic instinct was sort of was anti-American. And that, you know, that came from long before he was president. And, it sounds like from what Ewan's saying, this also is something that comes with Anwar going back a long time. Anyway, thanks again, as always, to our producer, Ian Ellis Jones, who has refined the art of making us look better than we merit. Please follow his popular geopolitical and military summaries on X at Ian Ellis Jones. And of course, if you've enjoyed today's episode, there's a lot more where that came from. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button. That helps you and it helps us. It also helps us if you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or YouTube. By the way, YouTube, where we are fast approaching 100,000 views after just 5 short months, or wherever else you hear our voices. That's it for this time, but let's talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.